So typically, I chose the longest, most difficult talk for the point in the retreat when everyone is tired. I thought it'd be a challenge for me. As I said this morning, the two convictions that really drove the ministry of John Paul II and all that he did and said was his belief, his understanding, and knowledge of who God is. And so we talked this morning, God the Father of mercies, Jesus the Son, the revealer of the Father and the Redeemer of man, and the Holy Spirit, the Lord and the Giver of life. The second great pillar of John Paul's preaching is the dignity of the human person, precisely in relationship to what we talked about this morning. When I began to kind of try to pull together the material for this retreat, and I looked at the body of teaching of John Paul II, which is just enormous, and started to kind of jot down ideas, I asked myself, well, what pulls this together? How can you synthesize this in a way that it becomes at least somewhat accessible and comprehensible, related to one another? And that's really what his understanding of the persons of the Trinity and the dignity of the human person. And what I'd like to do is, if I could use the analogy of the human person as a jewel, like a diamond that's been cut, I'd like to this afternoon look at 9 facets, or as many of those 9 as time will allow, different dimensions of this dignity and how it plays out in our lives. Some of them you may be familiar with through John Paul II's teaching, especially elements of that teaching that have been more publicized or more spoken about. I hope that some of them will surprise you and offer you some new insights. And he was, of course, not just the teacher or the proponent, he was really the champion of human dignity throughout the world. The man who defended dignity, especially where it was being assaulted, in terms of the violation of human rights, the violation of religious liberty, political tyranny, but also in things like human trafficking, pornography, anything that diminished this jewel, this object of beauty in the eyes of God, he championed. And he became, in many respects, the voice of the voiceless. After, I think it was his first trip to Africa, he asked some of the bishops there to help him form a statement, which is extremely poignant, where he said, I want to be the voice of the voiceless, the one who to speak for those who cannot speak for themselves. And if you followed his apostolic journeys, there were moments when he, for example, in Haiti, when the Duvaliers were still in power, in Cuba, in Nicaragua, and other places where it could have been difficult for him to go because it could have looked like he was compromising the church's stance on human dignity. Without directly insulting those who were in power, he did not draw back from confronting those aspects that were in violation of this great gift. So allow me now to make a few preliminary comments. From Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life, we read that God has granted to man a dignity that is near to divine. God has granted to the human person a dignity that is near to the divine. And again, those lines from Gaudium et Spes 22:24, by his incarnation, the Son of God has united himself in some way with every person. And this line particularly, the human person is the only creature that God has willed for its own sake. Everything else in God's eyes has a relative value. The human person has an absolute value. The beauty, the dignity is sufficient in itself for God to have created us. So I'll go on then. This is from Redeemer of Man. With each man, without any exception whatever, it'd be a great examination of conscience. What exceptions do I maintain in my mind when I'm thinking about people? Or I remember saying once to somebody, you know, God loves Bill Clinton. He really, you know, and it was, and the person, of course, who's going to not acknowledge that? But we're like, all right, okay, you know, he does. Or you could pick whoever was your persona non grata, you know. God loves Lady Gaga. He may not be Gaga over some of the things she does, but he loves her. So with each man, without any exception whatever, Christ is in a way united, even when man is unaware of it. Christ, who died and was raised up for all, provides man, each and every man, with the strength and the light to measure up to his supreme calling. From Redeemer of Man 13, man as willed by God, as chosen by him from eternity, and called and destined for grace and glory. So every human person has this inestimable, incomprehensible value because of who he or she is in his eyes, the fruit of his own direct creative activity, beloved, and a delight. And as I alluded to this morning, those two concepts, image and likeness, and how the human person, every human person is like a tiny mirror in which God can see himself reflected, like a parent looking into the face of their child. So for those of you who are parents, and you know that experience directly, when you hold your child and you see yourself reflected in your son and daughter, that gives us a faint glimpse of what God experiences when he looks upon us. Again, from the Roman triptych, and God saw that it was good. He saw and found a trace of his being. He found a reflection of himself. And as I, again this morning, the life which God offers to man is a gift by which God shares something of himself with his creature. And it is the teaching of the church, this is important to remember, that as much as the parents are involved in the procreation of a human being, that God acts directly and immediately to create the soul of each human person, which means that every human person is not the result of a chain reaction. Every human person was directly, immediately, explicitly willed by God. Their existence. They are here because God wants them here. He desires them. He delights in them, and he sees their beauty and their dignity. Every person by virtue of their existence. And that I love that the name of that deep amazement at this worth and dignity is the gospel. It is Christianity. And that really is why, because it could sound funny otherwise if you didn't understand it, why he will make the amazing statement that man is the way of the church. It sounds almost horizontal. What happened? I thought God was what the church was all about. But when you understand what he means, it makes perfect sense. The primary and fundamental way. Why? The way traced out by Christ himself that leads through the mystery of the incarnation and the redemption. And this is why, in philosophical terms, John Paul is called a personalist. Because at the center of his grappling with whatever issue may be involved is the dignity of the human person, the primacy of the human person. So looking at the first of these nine facets, very briefly, just to make a statement of which I'm sure we will all agree, the inviolable value of life itself. That is the gospel of life. And one commentator has described it as John Paul II's canticle to life. This is the gift that underlies every other gift. And what everyone really longs for more than anything else is not just life on the minimum level, but the fullness of life, the abundance, abundant life, thick, juicy life, life to the maximum, life to as much life as it can be. And in Evangelium Vitae, again, that penetrating gaze of the Father, in commenting on the punishment of Cain, John Paul II says that not even a murderer loses his personal dignity. Not even a murderer, the first murderer, the proto-murderer, Cain, not even he loses his human dignity because God is the Father of mercy. So facet one, the value of life itself. Now here's one that I hope will be a bit of a kind of mind-opener or eye-opener. The human mind or the intellect as a facet of dignity. And this really is what he is trying to get at in the encyclical Faith and Reason, Fides et Ratio. The opening statement, faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit rises to the contemplation of truth. God has placed in the human heart a desire to know the truth, in a word, to know himself, so that by knowing and loving God, men and women may also come to the fullness of truth about themselves. So I hope that point is coming across, because the Holy Father never sees Jesus or God or the Father as separated from, much less against, humanity. That in the discovery of Christ and his revelation of the Father, we really are figure out who we are. And in answering the question of Jesus, who do you say that I am? We're not just getting it right theoretically in a CCD class. That turns the light bulb on me. And that's why the question is so crucial. So he talks about the fundamental questions, of course, which pervade human life. Where, who am I? Where have I come from? Where am I going? Where is evil? What is their afterlife? And these are questions that have their roots in this quest for meaning that compels the human heart. Human knowledge is a journey which allows for no rest, which is why the church has the ministry of service to the truth. Now, those of you who have been to university may be somewhat aware of the kind of philosophical backdrop to this, because there is a skepticism about the human person's ability to know truth. Now, information is exalted, especially if you can digitalize it, if you can quantify it, if you can measure it, if you can manipulate it, then that information and data is of great value. But the possibility of knowing the truth about God, being able to state clear truths about just, and we live in a time of a funny contradiction, especially in the United States, because we have our Constitution that speaks about human rights, about an objective moral order, about a certain objective dignity of the human person, and yet in almost all other discourse we back away from that and we fall into indifferentism or relativism, or it doesn't really matter, or you can't really know. And this encyclical says no, the human mind can and has a thirst, a desire, and a longing for truth. And he points out in the encyclical that if you find out somebody is lying to you, that's a significant thing that affects, that destroys human relationships, and you're not going to trust that person again. So on a day-to-day basis, this knowledge of whether someone is speaking the truth or not is very significant. How much more on that macro level? But what I really want to point out and focus in on is something that he talks about, and I don't even have the number here, but wonder. Wonder. Wonder is awakened in human beings by the contemplation of creation. They're astonished to discover themselves as part of the world, in relationship with others like them, all sharing a common destiny. Here begins the journey which will lead them to discover ever new frontiers of knowledge. And listen to this, it's very much like what he said about love. Without wonder, men and women would lapse into a deadening routine, and little by little would become incapable of a life which is genuinely personal. So that ability, which is part of the intellect of every human being, to wonder. And again, children can be of a very, very helpfulness, because they wonder at things that we have forgotten to wonder about, whether they're insects or plants. And you know, it doesn't mean that we have to have these wow experiences all the time, you know, that are in the form of an action-adventure movie that has film clips cut to increase our adrenaline levels. I'm talking about the capacity on a daily basis, almost moment by moment, to live in amazement and wonder at the beauty of God, starting with the mystery of me, and then the mystery of you. And that is part of our intellect. It's part of that gift, that God-likeness, that value, that dignity of the human person. And so it's when our minds are open to reality in all of its breadth and mystery that we can wonder and marvel. And that our minds expand as we reach beyond ourselves into the world. Reason brings us to the threshold. And that's another great JP2 word, right? Adam, Monica, threshold. Image, likeness. You can have your little JP2 lexicon, right? So it brings us to the threshold of wonder, which faith enables us to cross. And this is another really important thing. And the more that I look at John Paul II and see what Pope Benedict XVI is doing, there's a clear trajectory. Because both of them want to say, no, the mind, your mind is one of the greatest gifts God has given you. And reason is not opposed to faith. Reason brings you to the threshold and tells you that there's something bigger here, and it's beautiful and it's marvelous. Faith can say you, and can say its name, and recognize that in Jesus, this mystery that my reason can recognize but can't fully grasp, that mystery has stepped onto the human scene in the person of Jesus and become incarnate. The Roman triptych, the stream. Number one, wonderment. Here let me pause, let me halt before a threshold, the threshold of pure wonder. The rushing stream cannot wonder as it descends and as the woods silently slope following its rhythm, but man can wonder. The threshold which the world crosses in him is the threshold of wonder. Once this very wonder was given a name, Adam. Now stop there for a second and think about what the Holy Father is saying. God created everything, right? The Garden of Eden, the sky, the sun, the moon, the stars, the water, the fish, the animals, the plants, the trees. None of them could wonder at what he created. So he created a being like himself who could look at all of this and say, wow. And that creature has a name, Adam, and has another name, your name. You have that capacity. That is part of your dignity. He was alone in his wonderment among creatures incapable of wonder. For them it was enough to exist and go their way. Man went his way with them, yet carried along by wonder. In his wonderment, he always emerged from the tide that bore him on. So it lifts us up and it opens that expanse for us, our minds. And by the way, it also involves a responsibility. We need to cultivate our minds. We need to use that gift of questioning, of trying to understand. And this is not the same as intellectual academic pursuit, but it does mean thinking seriously about life and being attentive and observant. One of the beautiful things about the Pope is one of the branches of philosophy he studied was called phenomenology. And it tries to avoid a pre-packaged response to anything, but to let the reality come out and reveal itself to me. And he could do it with confidence because the reality of Christ and God was so real that was unquestionable. But it prevented him from being ideological. Do you know as Christians we can be ideological? Do you ever know it, when you experience ideology, it's just like the intellect goes off and the recording goes on, right? And that you get the sense that, but are you really thinking about what you're saying? Did you really stop? And did you have the answer ready before the question was asked? And we can do that. We have these it's ideology. The Pope was not ideological. Third facet, imagination and creativity. The Pope's letter to artists. This is one of the wildest things he ever wrote. And it surprised people, like many of the other things. Why is he writing to artists? You know, aren't they kind of weird? Don't they, you know, they pierce themselves and they do weird things and they, you know, they just never seem to be happy and they dress funny and what's it all about? And, you know, why? What's he doing with that? So this is how he addresses the letter. To all who are passionately dedicated to the search for new epiphanies of beauty. He was an actor. You know, he seriously considered a career in acting. He was a poet and a playwright. And he says that artists sense something of the pathos of God himself. That comes close to Benedict XVI's Eros. There's pathos in God as he creates. And the human artist reflects the image of God, the creator. And he says this, the task of shaping our own lives is an artistic one. Is your life pretty or ugly? Is it pretty or very pretty? Is it pretty in part and ugly in part? Because of God the Creator and this gift that he's given us, we need to make of our lives a thing of beauty, which is different than beautiful living. I'm not talking about house beautiful. I'm not talking about liposuction and, you know, all this sort of other stuff where the, you know, the nip and tuck, add and take away, move this from here to there. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the quality of our life and our existence. He gives a spark of his own creativity to the human artist. And there is a relationship, he says, between goodness and beauty, so much so that society needs artists. And he says that art can be a bridge, because he recognizes, he's no dummy, he recognizes this alienation from religion. And so he's looking for moments or experiences or things where the human spirit opens in a way that God can provide an answer or a response. And this, he says, even in situations where culture and the church are far apart, art remains a kind of bridge. Thanks to the help of artists, the knowledge of God can be better revealed, and the preaching of the gospel can become clearer to the human mind. Art can even be a genuine source of theology. And allow me to read this passage particularly here. In order to communicate the message entrusted to her by Christ, the church needs art. Art must make perceptible, and as far as possible, attractive, the world of the Spirit, of the invisible, of God. It must therefore translate into meaningful terms that which is in itself ineffable. Art has a unique capacity to take one or the other face of the message and translate it into colors, shapes, and sounds which nourish the intuition of those who look or listen. It does so without emptying the message itself of its transcendent value and the aura of mystery. And that's why, by the way, I'm taking the time to quote some of John Paul's plays and poetry. Dostoevsky said that beauty, again when it's properly understood, will save the world. And the Pope speaks of, how about this for heaven? That infinite ocean of beauty, where wonder becomes awe, exhilaration, and unspeakable joy. The infinite ocean of beauty, where wonder becomes awe, exhilaration, and unspeakable joy. Here's his meditation on the book of Genesis as he's in the Sistine Chapel. I stand at the entrance of the Sistine Chapel. Perhaps all this might have been said more simply in the language of the book of Genesis. But the book awaited its illustration, and rightly, it awaited its Michelangelo. I'm calling you, all who see down the ages, I'm calling you, Michelangelo. In the Vatican, a chapel awaits the fruition of your vision. The vision was awaiting an image from the time that the Word became flesh. The vision continued to wait. We are standing at the threshold of a book. It is the book of beginnings, Genesis. Here in this chapel, Michelangelo penned it, not with words, but with the richness of a riot of colors. When Michelangelo left the Vatican, he left behind a polychromy, the key to which is image and likeness. Read in this key, the invisible becomes visible. Pre-sacrament. It's amazing how, in a sense, the Word of God in the Scriptures awaits the human translation into something, a work of art or beauty, a play, a poem, a painting, a piece of polyphonic music. And if I can give you an example from a secular source, because it really struck me when I saw it. How many of you have seen the film The Shawshank Redemption? Okay, most of you have seen it. So do you remember the scene when they're in prison and Andy Dufresne, who is in prison, has been writing to get books and things donated, and among the first donation is a record. And I looked it up. It's Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. And there's an aria there. And he puts it on the loudspeaker. Now remember, this is an oppressive, ugly place where the prisoners are less than human. And what happens with those two voices that people don't even understand? They're just... the whole prison population stops. And it's almost as though they awaken on another level of their being. It's an epiphany. And that's the power of beauty, especially when it is in communion with revelation, to move the human heart. And we have all received that spark. And both the appreciation and the ability to produce works of art is crucial. Even if it's done on a very... one of the sad things about the mass marketing of music and films is that grassroots beauty has been sort of banished, you know? But when that takes place, whether it's in the expression of music or art or drawing or little plays that are done, we are realizing that part of our dimension of our human dignity. So it's something I want to encourage you to do. Certainly the appreciation, but also the creation of beauty as an aspect of our dignity. Let me stop, by the way, and say something. At the end of Mass, and I'm thanking Josh for playing, I had a experience that was kind of interesting. When we were singing the song, I Will Worship, at the end, now I'm 48, right? Okay, thank you for not saying, oh no, Father, you don't look like a day over, you don't look a day over 47, really, you know, so. I went to Steubenville first when I was 18, 30 years ago. And I remember being blown away. And one of the things I really loved was like when you have the men's parts and the women's parts singing together, you know, first youth conference. During this Mass, I had like a deja vu or a flashback experience to what that first experience of Steubenville was like, that freshness, that beauty. And I just want to say to you all that there's something really good going on with you. There is something really good going on with Missioners of Christ. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that many of you are getting married and having children. I don't know. Or it's a level of your own maturity. But when I heard you laughing in the room last night, and we're in here praying, and I see how your lives are unfolding, God is doing something. He really is. And you need to be aware of that and grateful for that and go with that. And even in the way in which the ordination of Father Brian and a few other events, which are less significant for me than what I kind of sense and see happening among you. So thank you for that, and thank you for that little moment of spiritual freshness there. Next facet, the heart, will, conscience, and freedom. Veritatis splendor. Teacher, what good must I do to have eternal life? Just as in the case of truth, there is this, an even greater skepticism about right and wrong. Is there anything really right and wrong? I mean, we know that when the terrorists blew up the two towers, okay, that was wrong. I know that was wrong. But I'm a nice person. I mean, I really couldn't do anything wrong because I'm a nice person. So it's excluded from that fact. So if I do it, by definition, it can't be. But this whole obscuring of that. But he sees it as part of our dignity, the ability to recognize that. There is right and wrong. There is something that either helps or hurts another person. And we know that from our own immediate experience. So we can recognize that, distinguish it, and choose it. And I thought about this last week during that the gospel reading of John the Baptist and Herod. You know, when John is speaking to Herod, he's not using a religious argument. He doesn't cite the fifth commandment. He just says to him, you know that it's wrong for you to live with your brother's wife. You know this. You have a conscience. And that fascinated Herod. Maybe because nobody else would tell him the truth. You know, finally there's somebody that will tell me the truth. I better at least keep him around, you know. But it was based on that awareness. Our heart and our conscience is a compass that points us toward the fulfillment of our destiny in Christ. I already talked about freedom being liberated by love. And I'll just end this little segment with that quote from Camden Yards. You might have seen it on a t-shirt. Freedom consists not in doing what we like, but having the right to do what we ought. Don't cheapen your freedom to deciding between ice cream flavors. That's preference, and it's nice when somebody gives you that choice. That is not freedom. Freedom is the ability to say, this is good, this is right, this is my destiny. I will move myself toward what I know is good. That is freedom. That is freedom. Facet number five, women. The dignity of women. Two letters to women. One on the dignity and vocation of women, and then, which I think is an even more beautiful document, and if you were going to read one of the two, the letter to women written on the occasion of the conference on women in Beijing. The first is more theological. The second is kind of more personal. But he just goes through, again, some things we already know. The dignity of women in the Bible, and especially the New Testament, above all, expressed in the Blessed Virgin Mary. The way that Jesus treated women. And it's more expansive than we might think. You have Martha and Mary. You have the women in Luke chapter 8. You have the Blessed Virgin Mary. There's Mary Magdalene. There are women in the parables. The women are at the cross. The women are at the tomb. Women and the way Jesus treats them are very, very, have a very prominent role in the gospel. And he even says, and allow me to cite this, because this is pretty wild. He says that women have a uniquely prophetic role. In fact, he says There is present in the womanhood of a woman who believes, and especially in a woman who is consecrated, a kind of inherent prophecy. So ladies, you have an inherent prophecy, a powerfully evocative symbolism, a highly significant iconic character. That doesn't sound exactly like, oh, you want to ask somebody on a date and say, do you know you have a powerfully evocative symbolism and a highly significant iconic character? Could we go out for lunch someday? Well, it's a high compliment coming from the Pope, obviously. That it expresses the very essence of the Church as a community consecrated with the integrity of a virgin heart to become the bride of Christ and the mother of believers. When we consider the iconic complementarity of the male and female roles, two of the Church's essential dimensions are seen in a clearer light: the Marian principle and the apostolic Petrine principle. But beyond that kind of theological symbolic analysis, the Pope gets very practical when he speaks about how women bring a unique perspective to situations to which men can be blind, in all honesty. There is, and it can become frustrating. I've experienced that frustration myself when you're kind of planning something and something needs to get done, and a woman is there and she reminds you that what you're going to do is going to be perhaps hurtful to a particular individual. And you're like, well, that's too bad, but we still have to do that. But it really is, without that, we in the Church run a risk of being inhuman sometimes. And women's intuition, their sensitivity to life, their sensitivity to questions like... And we get... Men have the tendency to practice a very cold and sometimes cruel form of justice. Whereas women very often can bring a whole other dimension, a whole other perspective, and remind us that there's another way of looking at this. And the Holy Father was extremely sensitive to this, and I think some of you know that Marianne Glendon, a very pronounced legal scholar at Harvard, is the head of... Which Vatican congregation is it? Is it the... I'd have to look it up. But she led the delegation to Beijing, which consisted of a majority of women. So the dignity of women. Okay, now here's the wake-up call for all of you who are falling asleep. Human sexuality. I don't want to go into a lot of what has already been said about the theology of the body. I'm going to make just a few limited observations here. Men and women together reflect the image of God, not only in their souls, but also in their bodies and their sexuality. And this maybe is one of the most revolutionary aspects of authentic Catholic doctrine that the Holy Father emphasized. Human sexuality reflects the image of God. Human sexuality. And we all know what that means. I'm not going to draw pictures. But human sexuality reflects the image of God. And there is a presence of God in human sexuality. There's even, I could go as far as to say, there's a mysticism to sexuality. And this is what he says in the letter to families. Every act of begetting finds its primordial model in the fatherhood of God. God himself is present in human fatherhood and human motherhood quite differently than he is present in all other instances of begetting on earth. Indeed, God alone is the source of that image and likeness which is proper to the human being as it was revealed at creation. Begetting is the continuation of creation. God is covenanted to human sexuality in a way that is very similar to the way that Jesus is covenanted to the priesthood. It's almost an exact parallel. When a priest says the words of Jesus and does what the Church asks him, Jesus promises to bring that action to fruition. So he comes in the Eucharist, he forgives sins, he baptizes. When a man and a woman come together, even outside of the commitment of matrimony, and that union produces a child, that child is infused with the soul directly created by God. That is part of the dignity of sexuality. And it's really why it's sacred. And it's the basis of its mysticism. I read once, and I really wish I had saved it, Raniero Cantalamessa, in one of the talks that he gave, he is the preacher of the papal household, a Capuchin priest, very involved in the charismatic renewal, very big in evangelization. He does spiritual direction with a lot of couples, and he spoke about a couple who shared their experience in a moment of marital intimacy, which was really a very profound experience of the presence of the Holy Spirit. And if we have the right understanding of what the Holy Father is talking about, that becomes clear. So for him, sexuality has a profound nobility and honor, the expression of ecstatic self-giving. Now, those are two words that are important because I want to draw a contrast. Ecstatic, that means you come out of yourself and you focus on the other person. So when our sexuality is properly expressed, it's an exodus of myself and a focus on the other person, in which I give myself to the other person and my focus is on uniting myself with them. In contrast, the understanding of sexuality in contemporary sexual culture is orgiastic and vampiric, meaning that the focus is on me. I am going to maximize the physical and psychological satisfaction of a particular act. I'm going to take whatever drugs, use whatever devices, and use whatever person who I may need so that I, me, can have this heightened experience of sexual pleasure. It's the exact opposite. The focus is on me. It's almost, excuse the crudeness of this one, I need to be careful because we have children. It's almost a form of self-abuse. Just making use of another person. Because it's so self-centered and self-focused. And that's where you get, we all know the medications, right? Niagara and all the other stuff, right? And technique and all this garbage. But it's also vampiric. And this is where, Josh, you're telling me that priest was talking about the phenomenon of vampire movies, which is just bizarre. I mean, how many vampire movies can you make? How many varieties of vampires are there? Where does this come from? This is weird, right? But this is the point. That expresses the way that sexuality is practiced in our culture. It sucks the life out of people. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to look at some of those vampire movies and say, I think that there are some sexual overtones here, right? It's just not that, you know, it's pretty obvious there, right? But what happens, it's almost as though the sexual activity is mutated into the sucking of the blood out of the person, right? But that's almost supposed to express something sexual. And what's that saying is that my sexual encounter with you sucks the life out of you, so I have more life. It's the exact opposite of the Holy Father's vision of sexuality, where the goal is the giving of myself to you, not the sucking. And people who have been used in that way sexually feel that way and sometimes look that way. Like they've had the life sucked right out of them. Certainly the dignity and the value sucked right out of them. So again, that nobility of the human dimension of sexuality, but without becoming prudish. Let me just mention to you, there's a beautiful prayer from Częstochowa, August 15th, 1991. And it was one of those things when I read it was like, He says this, he's praying to Our Lady. Give mystery back to love and do so through purity. Through you, purity becomes a response to mystery. Blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. You know that impurity is the greatest corruption of the person, and from it hatred, murder, and wars are born. Somehow in our minds we think that purity really kind of takes away the spark of sexuality. So if I'm going to be pure, all right, then I have to settle for something less, right? But isn't it beautiful he's saying that purity, and he's asking Mary, through you purity becomes a response to mystery. There's a mystery of sexuality that is absolutely desecrated by pornography. The Pope says it doesn't show too much, it shows too little. Because the mystery is banished. So purity becomes a way of guarding the mystery. And you know, there's a way in which, especially, like, if you look at Arab women, right? like there's all that. Now I'm not making any recommendations about clothing here, okay? But it is mysterious, right? You see the woman, and she's kind of all wrapped in veils, and you're like, wow, that's really mysterious. That's kind of, you know, and there's a way, especially with feminine beauty, where part of the power of that beauty is how it's hidden and how it's guarded and how it's given to only one person. And even, like, you know, you don't have to have, like, stage lights of whatever how many wattage, you know? Even like, lighting, darkness, candle, you know, there's something mysterious. And when we drag it out into to the bright light of day and garish and you know, it just kind of ruins everything, you know? And not only that, you got to get liposuction and do all that other sort of stuff too. It's just kind of crazy, you know? So better to keep the mystery. But this is what he says to show that it doesn't lose its spark. And I love this when the Pope does stuff like this. Male and female, he created them. God bestowed on them a gift and a task. They accepted in a human way the mutual self-giving which is in him. Both naked, they felt no shame as long as the gift lasted. Shame will come with sin, yet the thrill remains, which means the thrill was there before. The thrill remains. They live conscious of the gift without being able to call it by name, but they live it, they are pure. Pre-sacrament, existence itself as the outward sign of eternal love. And when they become one flesh, that wondrous union. On the horizon there appears the mystery of fatherhood and motherhood. They return to the source of life within them. They return to the beginning. Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and gave birth. They know that they have crossed the threshold of the greatest responsibility. Let me just say this again about trajectory. It would have been almost impossible to think of Pope Benedict's encyclical on God is love and speaking about Eros and recovering that sense of the passionate love of God if John Paul II's theology of the body had not preceded that. So there's a profound linkage there. Marriage and the family. Again, something that has been discussed a great deal. I'll just make a few observations. One of the lines that I really like the most from his book, Crossing the Threshold of Hope, and I think I'm experiencing some of this in this retreat, he says, as a young priest, I learned to love human love. I learned to love human love. He was always very close to families. He worked with college students, so he saw them fall in love and get married. He saw them begin to have families. And he loved that. It's a beautiful thing to be able to watch and witness. And as a reminder, this is from the letter to families, a true subject of evangelization and apostolate within the church are families, spouses, and children. And raising children can be considered a genuine apostolate, a proper locus of missionary activity. So if you're a mother and someone says, well, what's your ministry? My ministry is raising my children. It's because it's a handful. And it's beautiful. But three ways in which the role of the family is crucial. The family as the sanctuary of life, schools of humanity, and the laboratory of love. Sounds like a... the laboratory of love. The family as the sanctuary of life. I once gave a homily called The Labyrinth of Love. It was where Jesus was saying, you know, I'm in you and you're in me and the Father's in me and you're in me while I'm in the Father and the Father's in me while I'm in you. And it's like, what is that? It's the labyrinth of love, getting lost in the intertwining of the love of the Trinity with us. The sanctuary of life. He says in the letter to families, it's necessary to go back to seeing the family as this sanctuary, as something sacred, the place in which life, the gift of God, can be welcomed and protected against the many attacks to which it is exposed. It can develop according to authentic human growth. In the face of the so-called culture of death, the family is the heart of the culture of life. And, you know, the older I get, the more I realize how important family is for survival. And, you know, for men, it's no secret that there's a much greater number of homeless men than women. Much greater. Probably 5 times the size. Because it's so much easier for men to, as you get older, your friendships can drift apart, and your even your relationship with your family, and you can end up alone very easily. But the family is the place where, and this is why dumb things that might seem dumb, like birthdays or graduations, are so important, because what we're really saying behind those is that you are really important to us. You're in the family, we try to be those messengers of God that communicate His love for each other member of the family. You can't do it for everybody, but you can do it for a small group of people. You know, like, let's break down into small groups. Maybe that was God's idea. Let's break down humanity into small groups. Why don't we do, like, we'll do groups of maybe, like, 5, 6, 7, and 8. We'll have 2 people in charge. We'll have the one who's responsible for the logistics, and then the other one who'll do the internal organizing. And, you know, it's a family, right? It's like we have finally discovered God's plan, you know. Breaking up into small groups is God's original idea. Families as schools of humanity. Now, this is becoming more urgent. Teaching a child how to be human with the ultimate goal of humanizing the world, because it's becoming less human. And that doesn't just mean, you know, like as we see on the men's room, you saw that the door, this is what I was reminded, I was in the kids' camp. Please remember to flush the toilets, you know, coming out. It's beyond just that and personal hygiene, okay? But it's how do you treat other people? What do you do with the gifts that God has given you? Discipline, responsibility, love, respect. Responsibility not just for you, but for the people around you. Respect to other people. Please and thank you. Showing up on time. You know, doing the work. Following through on what you've promised. All these basic human values. Where do we learn them? In the family. It teaches us how to be a human being. And finally, the laboratory of love. I don't want to go way into this, but Paul VI coined the phrase the civilization of love. And he is the one that said, and John Paul echoes, the family is the center and the heart of the civilization of love. Through the family passes the primary current of the civilization of love. It's the most basic building block of the civilization of love. I want to share with you a little story that happened to me at the beginning of August when I was at home in my home parish. I was celebrating Sunday Mass, and a group of 3 boys came in. And at first, I didn't realize they were related. I only got one of their names. The youngest one was named Zach. But as it turns out, there were 3 brothers. And as I found out later, the mother was the lector and the father was an usher. The middle boy was Down syndrome. And I began to watch the way these boys interacted. And at some point, it dawned on to me that they were brothers. I was overwhelmed by the way the eldest son looked at his middle Down syndrome brother. I could really meditate on this for whenever I remember it, I just stop. This boy was about 15 or 16, the height of ultra self-consciousness, right? And his little brother, he's cute. He all kind of, you know, went to, you know, we run over to the altar, and it was great. It was beautiful to see, but it could be embarrassing. But this older boy looked at his brother with such delight and pride. And all he wanted to do was just, he and his other brother, and as I found out his father, when he brought, all he wanted to do was help their other brother, you know, have a really good experience of serving and not do any, make any big goofs. So when the father brought up the gifts, he had the crew, he said, don't give him the glass. He's going to want the glass, but don't give him the glass. So I gave him the, you know, the metal ciborium. But it wasn't any kind of, it was no embarrassment. It wasn't for themselves. And I thought, as I realized what was happening, I thought, this is amazing. It's amazing to see how that boy looked at his brother. And I thought, there is something going on here. So I didn't want to, you know, like, draw too much attention to it, because especially that age, like, you don't want anybody, like, don't tell me I did a good job, because then I'm going to be really embarrassed, you know. I just said, you have a really good way with your brother. And I said something afterwards, I said to the pastor, who is that family? Because they were absolutely unobtrusive. They were not like people would walk around with, we are a Catholic family, t-shirts, you know. Very low-key, very, you know, like, they were not, sorry, I don't mean if anybody does that, no offense intended. No offense intended, it's okay if you wear a shirt that says we are a Catholic family. But they didn't have to because they were doing it. And it wasn't like they were trying to get anybody's attention doing it. They were just doing it. And when I said to Father Eric, who are they? Why haven't I met them before? They're like, they're my heroes, you know? And he said to me, the eldest son has a vocation. When he was going into high school, he had to write an essay of what's the most important thing in your life. His answer was faith. And this is not, you know, this is a, I would not have known. The kid doesn't stick out of the crowd in any way. Where did that vocation come from, do you think? The family has a Down syndrome child who is the delight of every other member of the family. That's it. And I'm sure they're not perfect. They probably fight, you know, they're whatever. But something's right. And that's really important. I'm not talking about being perfect. I'm not talking about making mistakes. I'm not talking about, you know, there's no underwear on the floor of your bathroom. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the quality of your relationship, the ability to forgive, authentic love. When there's real love, you can make a lot of mistakes and still get it right. What time are we doing? Tell me when I have to stop. Everybody's afraid to say, Father, you should stop. Yeah, there are two more facets. Sorry. You want the facets? Okay. Here's another one. Labor and work, sweating, exertion, laborem exertions. This is one of my favorite documents. John Paul II has a profound personalist, radical personalist approach to work, and this document got him in trouble with capitalists. Because, this is what he says, as a person, man is the subject of work. The primary basis of the value of his work is man himself. It should be judged above all by the measure of the dignity of the subject of work, the person, the individual who carries it out. In the final analysis, it is always man who is the purpose of work. The presence of a human being is greater than any other dimension of the process of production. Any other dimension. He says the human person can never be reduced to just another factor, object, or instrument in the process of production. And so he asserted explicitly the priority of human labor over capital, and the primacy of the human person. If I could use paraphrase for today's gospel, work was made for man, not man for work. If I could use the words of Jesus. Now, neither is the Holy Father a communist. There's a line in Jivitz's book, where the title of one of the chapters is No to Communism, but Not Yes to Capitalism. Now I'm going to modify that. The Holy Father is not against a free market economy. But he goes back again to the beginning, how God worked to create the human person, worked for 6 days, rested on the seventh day. Jesus says when they criticize him for performing miracles on the Sabbath, my Father is at work until now, and I'm working too. He was the son of a carpenter. He imbued work with an incredible dignity. And we were charged in the beginning to subdue the earth, to work. And even when, as a result of sin, labor became toil, something negative, something grinding, something difficult. And that was the curse of Genesis, right? Let me see if I can find the quote here. The cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. In the sweat of your face you shall eat. And women you will bring forth children in pain. He says that's an announcement of death. But even that can be redeemed by the exertion of the redemptive work of Christ. And in the Gospel of Luke there's a particular insight. When Jesus is wrestling in temptation and the blood breaks, Luke uses the kind of language that speaks about this incredible, almost physical exertion on the part of Jesus that is so intense that it causes his blood vessels to break. Jesus labored for us. And so even when work has that dimension of toil and heaviness and oppressiveness, even that can become redemptive. He says, sweat and toil, which work necessarily involves in the present condition of the human race, present the Christian with the possibility of sharing lovingly in the work of salvation. By enduring the toil of work in union with Christ crucified for us, man in a way collaborates with the Son of God for the redemption of humanity. And he will even speak of the gospel of work. And that applies to everything. Again, I think we have so much of a reductive vision. It implies to changing diapers. It applies to taking the garbage out. It applies to whatever labor, effort, intellectual labor is involved in our life. It's part of our dignity. And there's something God-like in it. And the last facet, economic and political life. And the two encyclicals are Solicitudo Rei Socialis and Centesimus Annus. His prophetic and personalist stance with regard to political and economic systems, insisting that the dignity of the human person be the criteria against which all political and economic systems are judged. Solicitudo Rei Socialis was written to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Paul VI's Populorum Progressio, in which he said something very significant. And this applies to you particularly as missioners. Paul VI said that development is the new name for peace, because he recognized that when there is grave inequality that engenders resentment, resentment becomes anger, anger becomes violence, it erodes culture and society, and can even get escalated to an international level. But if there's development, if there's hope, if things are moving forward, if there's possibility, that becomes a source of peace. And that encyclical particularly dealt with this very marked disparity between the very wealthy nations and the very poor nations. And he uses another biblical icon that John Paul also used when he came to Yankee Stadium in 1979. He said, this disparity can be likened to a gigantic development of the parable in the Bible of the rich banqueter and the poor man Lazarus. It was the biblical image the Pope gave to describe what this situation is like. And the remedy he offers is solidarity. He used that word deliberately. He used it as far back as Redemptoris Hominis in 1979. And when he used it in Solicitudo Rei Socialis, he used it on purpose, because that was the name of the labor union that helped to deal the death blow to communism. Solidarity is a firm and persevering determination to commit oneself to the common good, that is to say, to the good of all and each individual, because we are all really responsible for all. Solidarity helps us to see the other, whether a person, a people, or a nation, not just as some kind of instrument to be exploited at low cost and then discarded when no longer useful, but as our neighbor, a helper, to be made a sharer on a par with ourselves in the banquet of life to which all are equally invited by God. And in those two encyclicals, including Centesimus Annus, the Pope reiterates two fundamental principles of Catholic social teaching. First, technical name, the universal destination of created goods. What does that mean? That God created the goods of the earth to be enjoyed by everyone. God created the goods of the earth to be enjoyed by everyone, not just a few. His blessings were for all. That's his original, overriding, primordial intention. And then the second one is what is called the social function of private property. Or John Paul, he even puts it more strongly. He calls it the social mortgage of private property. Now, the church is a strong defender of private property. And it has to do, again, with the dignity. The human person has a right to dwelling and resources that he needs to use to develop himself and his family. The church is a strong proponent of that. But never in an absolute sense. Especially morally, meaning that, and this is part of solidarity, I do not have the right before God. I do not have the right before God to do what I like with what I have, without taking into consideration the needs of others. I want to say that again. I do not have the right before God to do what I want with what belongs to me, without taking into consideration the needs of others. And that applies, obviously, to people who have greater resources, but it applies in a small way. I recognize that what I have is something that God has given to me. He's entrusted it to me. I have a legal right to it, I have a moral right to it, but I don't have the right to use it in a purely self-enclosed way. I have to think of the needs of others. And if somebody does have the kind of resources or is in a position to direct kind of the market, it could be very significant. This is the note on capitalism that I want to present. Some people have seen John Paul II as a kind of unapologetic proponent of Western capitalism. That's not true. It's dishonest. Now, maybe that's a bit of a caricature. Maybe the people who present that would nuance it. And this is what he says in Centesimos Annos, because nor is he, does he reject elements of capitalism. If by capitalism is meant an economic system which recognizes the fundamental and positive role of business, the market, private property, and the resulting responsibility for the means of production, as well as free human activity in the market sector, then the answer is certainly in the affirmative. Although it would perhaps be better to speak of a business economy, a market economy, or simply a free economy. But if by capitalism is meant a system in which freedom in the economic sector is not circumscribed within a strong juridical framework, which places it at the service of human freedom in its totality, and sees it as a particular aspect of that freedom, the core of which is ethical and religious, then the reply is certainly negative. Okay, so he is talking about freedom. He is talking about private property. He's talking about initiative and business, but not unbridled, unrestricted self-interest projected onto the social level. Now, one of the early criticisms of capitalism had to do with the oppression of labor. You know, in the early 20s, Upton Sinclair wrote the jungle, right? You know, where people, it was almost a form of slavery, right? And that produced a reaction, and the church supported the organization of labor and unions, right? We have recently had another experience that was absolutely disastrous and was done legally. And that was the selling of mortgages, of debts, that had no value. And that was done legally. And it was done ultimately with the cooperation of both political parties in the United States for the expansion of eligibility for loans for people who didn't really have the ability to handle something like that, as well as the deregulation of the financial sector. If we need another reminder that a free market economy without strong ethical and juridical boundaries is absolutely necessary, check your net worth from mid-2008 till about like March of 2009. And not just yours, your parents. What happened to their retirement? So, and this is what he says in the Gospel of Life. Solutions must be sought on the global level by establishing a true economy of the sharing of goods. An economy of sharing. Whatever capitalism is in its raw form, it's not that. And this is what it is. Again, I'm not trying to be ideological because I'm not defending communism or socialism. I mean, socialism is going to probably submerge Europe into financial chaos very shortly. The unemployment rate in Spain is over 20%. It's not working, right? I just lost my train of thought. I'm coming back in. I'm slowly finding it again. The tractor beam is on. Yes. Behind economic and political systems is a vision of the human person. So whenever you're looking at an ideology or a political position, ask yourself, what understanding of the human person does that presuppose? What does it say about the human person? That was the Holy Father's criteria for judging everything. And you can see again the trajectory played out in Pope Benedict's encyclical Caritas in Veritate, also written on the anniversary of Populorum Progressio. I hope it doesn't seem that in looking at these nine facets of this jewel that I'm speaking theoretically. I'm speaking about you. These are dimensions of your life and your person, your mind, your will and your conscience, your creative capacity to recognize and respond to beauty and produce beauty, your ability to distinguish right from wrong and choose freely what is good and true and right. Your ability to enter into relationships. The gift of sexuality that God has given to you. Those of you who are women, those of us who need to respect the dignity of women, the work that we all engage in, and the fact that in one way or another, all of us are involved in financial and political life. The Lord has given us an incredible nobility, a nobility that has been tragically debased in the last 3 decades. If there is going to be a restoration of the dignity that really yace en cada ser humano, that resides, but the word yace, it has this better sense of like it rests in every human being. It has to start with a group of people who recognize their own dignity and have the ability to recognize and awaken that dignity in others. That's part of our mission.